So I just want to set the scene before I talk to my next guest and kind of give you a bit of the lay of the land and why it is that we're going to be having the discussion that we are. So the Church of England has set off a storm. It's a full-on storm by recommending engagement with Kairos 2. That's a document that critics say rejects dialogue, undermines Jewish self-determination, and pushes a one-sided political theology. It's had such a reaction that people like Chief Rabbi Ephraim Mervis have called the move shameful, warning that it harms Jewish-Christian relations and fuels a distorted narrative about Israel. So today we're going to look into what actually this Kairos 2 document actually is, why the Synod's decision matters, and whether in fact this crosses a line from political critique into something far more troubling, as if things weren't troubling enough for the Jewish community in the United Kingdom. And to help us come to grips with this subject is my next guest. He is Greg Swenson. He is chairperson of the Republicans Overseas UK branch and co-founder of the Hamilton Society. Greg, thank you so much for chatting to me here on Chai FM in Johannesburg.
My pleasure. Great to be with you.
So, Greg, before we get into the politics, help us understand the basics here. What is this Kairos 2, and why has it triggered such an incredibly strong reaction from Jewish leaders?
Yeah, so Kairos 2, I mean, I wouldn't call it, you know, anything as quite as meaningful as, say, in the Catholic Church, Vatican II, where, you know, there's major changes or major announcements. It's just a virtue signaling moment, again, for the Church of England. They've done this before on, you know, trans issues and other sort of, you know, controversial but progressive woke issues that, you know, really they should have little to nothing to do with unless they're taking the side of a more traditional or specifically religious argument. And that's what's interesting is it's never, you know, the churches are empty at the Church of England. It's turned into this godless country. If it wasn't for the Catholics and the Jewish community, as well as whether we like it or not, the other major religion in the UK, you know, there wouldn't be, you know, there's virtually, you know, I would just say they're failing at their mission is probably the best way to describe it.
It's very interesting because I, in my mind, made the linkage between the Vatican II and the Kairos document. It's interesting to hear you say that you can't make that comparison. So that's already somewhat reassuring. So thanks for the clarification. Yeah. But meanwhile, back at the ranch, the chief rabbi isn't particularly happy. Chief Rabbi Mervis has said Kairos rejects dialogue. It challenges the very existence of Israel. Yeah. From your reading of the document, I don't know if you have read it or not, but is this an exaggeration or is that genuinely what the document does?
I don't think it's an exaggeration in the sense that, you know, the Church of England has been, you know, for lack of a better word, wokeified. And so they're, you know, consistent with the universities here, the current government here, the media in the United Kingdom, or at least the legacy media, are really embracing these things. And so, you know, is it going to move the needle in terms of, of moving hearts and minds? Probably not, because there's such a small following now of the Church of England. I think it would have been, you know, much more controversial if this came from an institution in the United States, a religious institution, because the United States, you know, people still worship. You know, there's still it's still a God-fearing country in a good way. I say that in a very positive way. I think that the rabbi is right. It is shameful. And I do think it's just typical, but I don't think it will move the needle because every other woke progressive institution has already piled on to this myth, this moral equivalence argument, which I find really obscene. But again, I think given how weak of a position the Church of England is in, I'm not too worried about, this escalating the anti-Semitism in the UK. I think that's already here, unfortunately.
Critics say that the document doesn't just oppose Israeli policy. It goes further than that because it attacks the core idea of Jewish nationhood. And I'm just wondering, yeah, to what extent, I'm guessing with my very limited knowledge of Christianity, that this is an adoption of kind of a, what's it called, the replacement theology. Is that what's happened in the Anglican Church? Have they embraced replacement theology? Is that what's going on here?
You know what? I think they have. Again, they love this moral equivalence. And instead of trying to preach Christianity and embrace, you know, sort of Judeo-Christian values, they're going the other way. And I can contrast it, you know, because I split my time between the U.S. and U.K. and I'm an American, you know, for by birth. And I think, you know, we've found I'm Catholic personally, but I've found a really robust relationship between especially evangelical Christians in the U.S. And the Jewish community and Israel specifically. And I think, you know, Mike Huckabee, the ambassador to Israel, is a perfect example of that, you know, a evangelical minister turned politician. And, you know, he's a great example. And yet the woke sort of traditional or older Protestant churches in the U.S., you know, the snobby kind of the Anglican Church or the Presbyterians, they have kind of abandoned Israel and don't see that, don't appreciate the relationship between Jews and Christians. Whereas the evangelicals, the Southern Christians, are much more prone to support Israel. And I think that's healthy. And you'd surely never hear this from I hate to use the word traditional because it could be confusing, but, you know, the more active churches, the active Christian churches are much more prone to support Israel, whereas the old, you know, kind of snobby Northeast Protestant churches
How do you explain that? How do you explain that they're having silent rave nights in churches? How do you explain this? And I don't know to what extent it's true because I haven't been in the UK for a while, but is it in fact true that the churches are empty on Sundays and really struggling to connect with its base?
They really are. And I think there's been, you know, I've been in New York a lot lately. There's a resurgence of young people going and participating in Christian worship, but it's more in the traditional Catholic Church rather than these kind of woke, you know, happy clappy churches that, you know, that sort of we've seen since Vatican II 50 years ago. And so it's really interesting what's happening in the U.S. compared to the U.K., where there are young people going to church. I mean, you see headlines in especially in the conservative papers, because the legacy media never wants to admit it. But, you know, young people here are embracing Christianity, but a more traditional Christianity, not the sort of Church of England, you know, woke, let's have a rainbow flag part, you know. And it's really fascinating how there's this almost a divide, not divide, it might be exaggerating, but there surely is a difference between the, as we call it, not only in the Catholic Church, but in some of the Anglican churches, the Church of England, they're still with, you know, what we call smells and bells. You know, they have incense, they ring bells, they have a choir, they have an organ. And those are the ones that tend to be more traditional and pro-Israel. And I can say that about the Catholic Church from my own experience. Whereas, you know, these sort of, progressive virtue signaling churches that, you know, that have embraced every woke issue. I mean, the Church of England basically shut down during COVID, during the pandemic, and refused to look after their especially their elderly congregants, and it was really a shame. And the running joke, there's a guy named Douglas Murray, a great conservative writer. He said, if you really want to understand about social distancing, just go to a Church of England mass on any Sunday. You know, and that was, you know, that's because the attendance was so low you could hardly tell the difference between, you know, pre-COVID and during COVID. But so, you know, I know I sound like I'm picking on the Church of England, but I think it's
I wanted to pick you up on that because I think you've given Catholicism a bit of a free pass. I mean, if I look at the countries who are most virulently anti-Israel today, I'm thinking of a country like Spain, I'm thinking of a country like Ireland, maybe even parts of Italy, and I'm looking at what is the common factor between those countries. I arrive at Catholicism.
Yeah.
I know that's not entirely fair because the whole of South America is also Catholic and they're not. But I mean, it's clearly an issue.
But you bring up a really good point, because people in Western Europe do not go to church anymore, even though they're traditionally Catholic countries.
Interesting.
They've lost their faith. I mean, and my American friends here in the UK, we're often very critical of that. I mean, to the point where we kind of joke around about it. But you know, it's just you're not going to see that commitment. And that's one of the reasons I think that anti-Semitism and anti-Israel, you know, is so prominent. Ireland's got their own unique situation. They too have rejected the Catholic Church. I mean, they just voted for abortion in the last 10 years, and it wasn't even close. So they have become, sort of the woke progressive, and I'm not saying all the people, but surely the institutions, the media, the universities for sure. I mean, I spoke at Trinity College, last year, and that was, at a debate society founded by Edmund Burke. I mean, this was a beautiful and traditional university, and it was hostile. It was downright hostile, because I was, very pro-Israel in my comments. And even the Democrat that was speaking with me, who obviously was, a person of the left, but I was worried for her safety because she wasn't anti-Israel enough. They weren't satisfied that she wasn't pro Hamas enough. I find it, it's troubling. And also Ireland has a little bit of that, that kind of colonial chip on their shoulder. And I get it. I understand it. I'm Irish myself, or Irish descent, but, so they, that's why they try to connect the dots of Israel being, the
colonialist oppressive
state, the senior. Yeah, and it's really unfair. And I'd point out one thing. If you haven't read it already, there's a guy named John Spencer. Just not that I don't even have these discussions about, is it genocide or not, because it's so absurd and it's so obscene. And so I don't even want to bring myself to do that. But it's worth reading an article by John Spencer. He's the chairman or the head of the Urban War Institute at West Point. He is like a real authority on urban warfare. And, he talks quite a bit about how the IDF has gone to enormous lengths to keep civilian casualties down. Who's the bad guy here? I mean, Israel's the bad guy and Hamas is the good guy. I mean,
no, it's an inversion of everything that makes sense in this world.
It's like a Jedi. It's a Jedi mind trick. I just don't understand. It's amazing how the progressive institutions have been able to create this farce. And but anyway, the urban, the typically urban warfare, the civilian to soldier, or to military ratios, 8-1, 9-1. And that's recently, that's in the last 40 years. Forget about Dresden and Tokyo and other, World War II situations. But, it's usually 8-1. And the Israelis, the IDF has got it down to 2-1. They drop leaflets on buildings. They give them the heads up. They put maps out and help do their best to, and by the way, giving up the element of surprise as well. So, they're often sacrificing soldiers on the behalf of Palestinian residents or, civilians. So I don't buy it, and it's not even worth getting into. But so the good news is I don't think that the Church of England has much of an influence anymore, because nobody really listens to them. But the bad news is it's troubling that that these institutions feel that way, and that's what really worries me.
Greg, I'm out of time. Thank you so much for chatting to me on Chai FM. Not the last time we speak, I'm sure of that.